When I was attending college, I used to work every Saturday doing odd jobs to earn extra money. And I'd usually leave my dorm at about 6:30 a.m. and return back around dinner time with a little bit of cash in my pocket and in desperate need of a shower. And one semester, I was able to work with a landscaping company that did much more than just mow lawns and trim hedges. They were more of a landscape design company. And so they would look at a backyard and envision all of the grass torn up and new lush sod placed neatly in lines. And they would bring in heavy equipment and level off a portion of the yard to build a fish pond or a rocky waterfall. And they would haul in 25 hedges at a time and plant them in straight lines along the back of the yard. They would completely transform a yard into a beautiful landscape that was pleasant to the eyes and reminiscent of an opulent, luscious garden. And one Saturday, I was carrying a particularly heavy shrub over my head as mounds of dirt fell from the roots and scattered it through my hair and all down my back. But as I worked, I felt as though I were a truly substantive part of the creation of this backyard landscape. And in fact, God has communicated to us the ability to create beauty and works of art and majesty. But this ability that's been communicated to us is derived from the supreme creator, who in his superlative creativity has made this universe and everything in it. The title of the sermon this morning is From Landscapes to Skyscapes in Just a Few Words. From Landscapes to Skyscapes in Just a Few Words. We're in verse 9 this morning of Genesis 1. Verse 9 says, "And God said, Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so." Let the waters under the heaven be gathered unto one place, and let the dry land appear. So at this point in creation, you had the earth, and it was going through cycles of evening and morning, and you had a light source that was causing these cycles to occur, and quite probably a spinning globe that was rotating around this light source. And this globe was covered in water. Remember, the Spirit of God was hovering on the face of it. Maybe he still was. And you have an expanse that God named the sky. And so you have a globe with a sky and waters below the sky and waters above the sky. And you have 2 days. And now on day three, God is going to begin to make this earth habitable. So God takes all of the water on the globe, and instead of covering the whole globe, he puts the water all by itself in one portion of the globe. And that leaves room for his next creation, land. But not just land, dry land. So had God already created the land, or did he create the land at this point in verse 9? Or did he just move the waters out of the way and turn the wetland into dry land? So that question is begged because he says, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear." So the word land is modified by the word dried, and then it says, "Let the dry land appear." So does that mean that the land was already in existence and it simply appeared now that he moved the waters into one place, or did he actually create the land at this point? Well, we don't have an answer to this question. However, it would seem to make sense from the Genesis account that the matter that was used to form the dry land already existed on day one. The earth could have been just a mass of water with no matter, with no land prior to day three, But I think there's evidence to suggest that the matter with which God formed the dry land already existed. In other words, this land was under the water, and he simply moved the water into one place, and the dry land appeared. And so the reasons for this is, first of all, God said on day one that he created the earth. So it would seem to follow that God created the necessary components of the earth, the land and the water. Secondly, God uses the term dry land rather than just land. If the land was buried under the water, then it wouldn't be dry. Therefore, it would follow that God simply formed the dry land rather than created land itself. Thirdly, God commands the dry land to appear or to be manifest or even possibly to be seen. These are all different ways that one could translate the word appear. So you might say, let the dry land be seen. In other words, it wasn't seen because it was covered under the water, so let it appear or let it be seen. It was already there, potentially. Additionally, turn to Psalm 104. We'll go back to Genesis in just a moment. If you look with me at Psalm 104, we'll look at verse 5. Now, quick note on Psalm 104. Some believe that Psalm 104 is referring to the flood that was sent in the time of Noah. Most, however, believe that Psalm 104 is referring to the act of creation, the creation of the world. I would hold that Psalm 104 is referring to the creation of the world, specifically because of verse 5 and how it begins here in verse 5, who laid the foundations of the earth that it should not be removed forever. Thou coveredst it with the deep as with a garment. The water stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled, at the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. They go up by the mountains, they go down by the valleys, unto the place which thou hast founded for them. That can also be translated that the mountains ascend and the valleys descend. So verse 8 might shed some light on what was happening here. Perhaps the psalmist is giving us an account of what actually happened when God made the dry land appear. However, the passage could be descriptive of this, but it is poetry, and so it's not meant to be a narrative history. So it may help to shed some light on this question of whether or not the land was already there, but I'm not sure that it seals the deal. The psalmist may or may not have been describing exactly what the creative act looked like. Go back with me to Genesis 1 and verse 9. And look at the last phrase of verse 9. We see this repeated throughout Genesis 1, and it was so. So whether or not God had already created the matter which he used to form the dry land or not is actually inconsequential when you consider what happened. Consider God's questioning of Job in Job 38, 1 through 11. You can turn there if you like. Job 38, 1 through 11. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut up the sea with doors, when it brake forth, as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud, the garment thereof, and the thick darkness, and swaddling band for it, and brake up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors. And he said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed." consider what happened. God is the master of water. God can stretch a mountain into the sky and cause a massive amount of water to rush into a basin to form a sea. What an amazing act of creation. What amazing power. Last week, the southern east coast of the U.S. saw a massive hurricane that brought devastation and flooding. The winds were howling 90 miles per hour when the Category 1 hurricane touched down in North Carolina. Evacuation orders were given to certain coastal districts days before the hurricane came. Boats were ordered out of the harbor. Grocery store shelves were emptied within days. Home Depot, Lowe's, and other hardware stores saw huge profits as residents in the path of this hurricane purchased boards, generators, and flashlights. And with all of the preparation and evacuation and pandemonium, that storm was not going to be told what to do. It was going to devastate what it was going to devastate, and helpless and hapless individuals could only sit back and watch. But God is the God of the storm. He is the God of the waters. He is the God of the dry land. And one day, God will judge the world. And just like that hurricane in North Carolina, those who have not followed Jesus and believed, truly believed, to the point of repentance of sin and complete surrender to Jesus as Lord, will find themselves in the wake of the hurricane of God's everlasting judgment. Believe in the God of the dry land. Look at verse 10. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And as he has been doing up to day 3, God again exercises his rightful dominion over his creation and names this dry land. He calls it earth. And so we call it earth today. I like the Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary's definition of the earth. This is how the Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary defines the earth. The habitation of human beings, viewed physically as land, soil or ground, geographically as a region, politically as a state, territory, or country, cosmically as the opposite of heaven, and symbolically as the entirety of material existence. This creation account of God creating the dry land, beginning to make our home habitable, is exciting. This is our home. Some do live on boats. Some live in an international space station in the sky. Some talk of living in colonies on Mars. Some talk of traveling to distant planets and galaxies and planning for a time when this earth is no longer sufficient for the existence of humans. But man was meant to live here, right here, where we are at this moment, on this dry land, earth. And so we thank God, and we ought to thank God for this earth, for the home of his creation, who was ultimately created for Christ to the glory of God. Then he says, and the gathering together of waters he called seas. So instead of a globe that was in its entirety covered in water, God created a body of water. He called this body of water seas. Now, if he gathered the waters into one place, then why was it called seas, plural? Well, the dry land could have all been one landmass prior to the flood, which would have caused one big sea. If you have one landmass and all the waters are separated from that landmass, then you have one big sea. But even today, with one large body of water, we still say seas, plural, like sail the seas. These seas, however, are interconnected. The Pacific touches the Atlantic, the Philippine Sea touches the East China Sea. It is all one body of water, but many seas. Additionally, God created rivers that ran around the Garden of Eden. When God says that he gathered the water into one place, it does not mean that it was there and nowhere else. It means that he harnessed the waters. He made the sea. Let me make a note here also about this plural. In regards to Hebrew plurals. Just because a noun in Hebrew is in the plural form, that plural form is not always indicative of quantity, meaning it doesn't necessarily mean that there are two or three or four or five or more than that. It could simply mean one. There is a plural form in Hebrew called the intensive plural. This plural is used to show the greatness of a thing or the majesty of the thing described. In this case, the word seas is not a plural of quantity. In other words, the author of Genesis 1 is not trying to say that there were seas, like multiple seas, but this is a plural of quality or intensity. This is to show that he formed the great sea. He separated all of the water by itself and made the seas. And then God saw that it was good at the end of verse 10. Here again, God's affirmation is described. His judgment, his affirmation, his regard of goodness is paramount to our understanding of his creation, and from it cannot be separated. The earth and the seas were good. Let's look at verse 11. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth." And now this desert earth with no vegetation of any kind. Imagine that sight. Imagine for a moment you have one landmass, a complete desert, dirt. No plants, no trees, no animals. As far as the eye can see, surrounded by water. And this earth is told to bring forth vegetation and plants and trees. The Hebrew word here that's translated as grass is probably not referring to grass specifically, but more generally to vegetation or lush green vegetation. So God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass or vegetation, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind." What do you notice in day three here in verse 11 that's different than how God created in the previous days? What kind of language here does he use that's different from when he created the firmament, the sky, or light? Well, on day three in verse 11, he allows the plants and trees to grow. And so rather than saying, "Let there be plants," or "Let there be trees," he actually commands the earth to bring them forth. So he actually commands that they grow rather than just becoming, just being. Now, he did, however, still create through speaking, but he let them grow into full-grown plants and trees in one day. Normally, a fruit-bearing tree or plant would grow up very slowly and over time eventually become capable of fruit-bearing. A blueberry bush, for instance, can take 3 to 4 years of growth before it's capable of bearing fruit. A peach tree will not begin to bear fruit for 2 to 3 years after planting. Raspberry bushes are much faster, but can still take between 16 and 18 months before they will produce raspberries. However, these plants and trees grew miraculously, being created and in just one day able to bear fruit. Look at this phrase, "after his kind," in verse 11. This means that there are certain categories of plants. Some are trees. Some are fruit-bearing plants. Some are grass. And each category of plants, each kind, can reproduce plants of the same kind and not of a different kind. God has bound his creation by their kinds. Now, this is not to say that different species of plant cannot intermingle with other species, but simply that of kinds. So this explanation contradicts the belief in evolution that says different kinds evolved over time. God not only clearly stated that he created, but that he created kind to produce kind. And it was so. And so it was. Verse 12. And the earth brought forth grass, an herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And just as in the creation of the firmament or expanse, we have in verse 11 the command, and in verse 12 the effect. So you look at verse 11 and you look at verse 12 and they seem identical. In verse 11 you have the command, let the earth bring forth. In verse 12, and the earth brought forth. And this is a pattern that we've been seeing as we've been going through the days of creation. The command and the effect, or the carrying out, or the fulfillment of the command. So this way the reader knows that it actually happened. If all we had was the verse that said, let there be, or let the earth bring forth, I suppose we could read the text and say, well, did it actually occur? It would be pretty obvious because we can look around and see that we're here and it did. But God shows the effect or the fulfillment of his command, and it actually happened. It was so. I just want to make a quick note on the phrase, whose seed was in itself. This just simply means the seed was in the fruit. This could also be translated, fruit after their kind with seed in them. And God saw that it was good. So every time one of the phrases, and it was so, or God saw that it was good, comes up, part of me wants to skip over it because we've kind of covered it already. And it keeps coming up again and again on every day of creation. And it's easy just to read it and skip over it. But let's not forget that God saw that the life-producing dry ground and the green verdant vegetation and the seed-producing plants and the fruit-bearing trees were good. God affirms that. He judges his creation to be good. And verse 13, the evening and the morning were the third day. One 24-hour day, probably measured by the rotation of this globe, full of dry land and water and green vegetation and plants and trees around the created stationary light source. 3 days. Let's get into day four. Verse 14, and God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And now on day four, God will create very specific light sources that give us light to this day. Now, the day and the night were already divided. We know this because we've already had three evenings and mornings. So in verse 14, when God says, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, he isn't here instituting the division of light and dark. That's already been instituted on day one. The light was already created on day one. So now God is simply creating receptacles of that primordial light that would be created. But what is the function of these lights? Well, you might say, isn't it obvious? They give light to the earth. Yes, that was one function of these lights, but there were other functions as well. For instance, the one mentioned here in verse 14, these lights function to separate or to divide. The function of these lights was to separate the day from the night. And so the function of these created light sources is to separate. But what are their other functions? Well, verse 14 gives these light sources, which we know to be the sun and the moon, other functions as well. Let them be for signs, it says in verse 14. Well, what is Moses referring to when he says that the function of the sun and moon and the stars is for signs? Well, consider these verses. Matthew 2:2 says, saying, where is he that is born, the king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. Luke 21:25, And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Joel 2:30-31, and I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. Jeremiah 10:2, thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. Matthew 24:29-30, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. God uses the heavenly lights that he created on day four as signs, or as one writer put it, as distinguishing marks rather than omens for what is to come. Even Jesus himself is called the morning star in 1 Peter 1:19 and Revelation 2:28 and Revelation 22:16, using the lights that were created on day four to describe his own majesty and the hope of his coming and the ushering in of his eternal day. So these lights, the sun, moon, and stars, they function as signs. What's another one of their functions? Well, verse 14 gives us another one here, and for seasons. Acts 14:17 says, nevertheless, he left not himself without witness, in that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Leviticus 23:4 says, these are the feasts of the Lord, even holy convocations, which ye shall proclaim in their seasons. Jeremiah 8:7 says, yea, the stork in the heaven knoweth her appointed times, and the turtle and the crane and the swallow observe the time of their coming, but my people know not the judgment of the Lord. In Psalm 104:19, he appointed the moon for seasons. The sun knoweth his going down. So how do these light sources cause the different seasons to occur? Well, I'm going to allow an article on NASA Space Place to explain this for us. Earth's axis is an imaginary pole going right through the center of the Earth from top to bottom. Earth spins around this pole, making one complete turn each day. That is why we have day and night, and why every part of Earth's surface gets some of each. Earth has seasons because its axis doesn't stand up straight. As Earth orbits the Sun, its tilted axis always points in the same direction. So, throughout the year, different parts of the Earth get the Sun's direct rays. Sometimes it is the North Pole tilting toward the Sun around June, and sometimes it is the South Pole tilting toward the Sun around December. It is summer in June in the northern hemisphere because the sun's rays hit that part of the earth more directly than at any other time of year. It is winter in December in the northern hemisphere because that is when it is the South Pole's turn to be tilted toward the sun. So these lights function as seasons. And there's a fourth function in verse 14, and for days and years. The fourth function in verse 14 of these light sources is for days and years. By the rotation of our earth around the sun, we calculate and divide up years and months and weeks and days and hours and minutes and seconds. The division of years and days by the heavenly bodies was actually of great importance to Israel. Israel used these important divisions to mark their prescribed feasts and festivals to the Lord. And even today, on this very day, we use these divisions of days and years to mark a very special day, the Lord's Day. And we meet on this day because Jesus rose from the dead on this day, the third day. days and years were extremely important when it came to prophecy. Jesus himself in Luke 4 was reading the scroll of Isaiah. He was reading out of Isaiah 61 and said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he hath appointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And then Jesus sat down and told the crowd that that prophecy had been fulfilled today. And so we have the function of these light sources for days and years. And they're important to us today to tell us when to meet, what day to meet. They were important to Israel in their feasts, not only days, but also years. They were even important in prophecy to Jesus, as Jesus mentions the acceptable year of the Lord. One columnist and lecturer wrote this of keeping time in our night sky. The title of his column was 4 Minutes a Day. As our earth whirls through space around the sun, its motions cause night and day, the four seasons, and the passage of years. If we were to synchronize our clocks using the motions of the stars as a reference, we would discover that the earth completes a single turn on its axis not in 24 hours, but actually 4 minutes shy of that oft-quoted figure, 23 hours, 56 minutes. As a result, the stars appear to rise across the sky and set 4 minutes earlier each night. This amounts to a whole hour earlier in 15 days and 2 hours earlier in 30 days. A little quick arithmetic shows that with a difference of 2 hours per month, then in 1 year, the cycle will come full circle. 12 months times 2 hours equals 24 hours. Since each star completes a full circle around the sky during the course of 1 year. This can be made clear by trying an experiment. Suppose you look skyward tonight and pick out a bright star, and then line it up with a nearby landmark, like a telephone pole or the peak of your neighbor's roof. Make sure you note the exact time and the exact spot when you lined up the star. And then come back the next night at the exact same time and stand in the exact same place. You'll see that the star has apparently shifted slightly to the right or west of the position that it was at the previous night. Had you arrived 4 minutes earlier, the star would have lined up exactly with the nearby landmark, just as you had seen the previous night. This apparent westward drift of stars, incidentally, is a motion that is an addition to the daily rising, circling, and setting, because the Earth does not simply stand in the same spot in space and spins, but is constantly rushing eastward along its orbit around the sun. It carries us steadily toward and under the stars to the east and away from the stars that we are leaving in the west, until we make a complete circle around the sun, bringing us back to our original position in 1 year. And then the whole performance starts again. So the light functions for days and years. And what amazing precision that God hung our planet in this way and spun it in this way and put these light sources in this way so that continually throughout all generations, these lights that God created on day four could serve these functions, these purposes, to be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and to separate, to divide, and to give us light. Let's look at verse 15. "And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. So verse 15 is that other function that we mentioned earlier. They're for us. These lights are for us. For this earth, they function as lights for plants and animals and humans. They are our created lamps. And God said, "Let there be," and there was. It was so. Verse 16. "And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. So we know that the greater light is the sun, and we know that the lesser light is the moon. So what does it mean that one is lesser and one is greater? Well, God's not explaining that one is more important than the other, but rather that one is more brilliant than the other. We would say it's brighter. God says greater. The sun's light is greater than the moon's, and the moon's light is lesser than the sun's. But what of this word rule? Look at verse 16 again. The greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. What does that mean? What does it mean that the sun and moon rule over their respective time frames, day and night? Well, it's interesting to note that when considering this question, the sun and the moon have been seen as deities down through the millennia. Perhaps a perversion of Genesis 1:16 is why other false religions have seen these two created light sources as deities. The term rule, however, does not signify or convey that the sun and moon can act as independent authority figures. Their authority to rule is simply derived from the true authority who has created them and who upholds and sustains them. The sun and moon are not gods or powers. They function as light bearers to the earth. And they rule insofar as they are regulators of the dividing of day and night, bringing about the signs and seasons and days and years, and inasmuch as they dominate the day and night. The day and night are dependent upon these lamps. And at the end of verse 16, we come to possibly my favorite portion of a verse in the Bible. He made the stars also. For years, I've chuckled at this phrase every time I read it, like a little tagline. Oh yeah, and by the way, he made the stars also. Did you know that it is estimated that just in our galaxy alone, there are 100,000 million stars? And that is just our galaxy. Beyond our galaxy, it is estimated that there are millions upon millions of other galaxies. So scientists estimate approximately 70 billion trillion stars in the universe. This would be 10 to the 22nd power. I'm not sure how many zeros. And this is all that is said about it. And he did it in one day. We simply cannot begin to fathom this God. His ways are higher than our ways, and his thoughts than our thoughts. But you know what we can do with a God this unfathomable? We can trust him. We can rely on him. We can bow to him. We can obey him. We can cling to the God who also made the stars. Verse 17. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. So is verse 17 redundant? Or do we learn something new here? Well, at first glance, the verse seems to simply repeat the aforementioned function of the sun, moon, and stars to give light to the earth. But we already knew that from verse 15. So then what's the difference here? The difference is that he set them. He set them in the firmament of the heaven. He does repeat the function, but he moves beyond the command of creating them and describes their placement. God placed the sun and moon and stars exactly where he wanted them. If the earth were any closer to the sun, all of the earth's water would boil and all living creatures would die. If the earth were any further away from the sun, all of the earth's water would freeze and all living creatures would die. God placed the heavenly bodies with exactness and perfection. He set them in the expanse. He set them in the firmament of heaven. Verse 18. And to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. This again is the act of doing. This is the fulfillment or the achievement, the realization of the command in verses 14 and 15. It's the effect. And now he puts these created heavenly bodies in their proper place to do their prescribed jobs, and God saw that it was good. He judges, affirms, appraises, evaluates, reckons, and determines that these heavenly bodies, in all of their intricacy and with all of their functions and in all of their vastness, are good. In verse 19, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And day four would have been the first day that the sun and moon would ring in, the evening and the morning. What an amazing sight. A sight which I, and probably most of you, will never get tired of seeing. The next time you look at a sunrise, if you're up that early, or a sunset, just remember that it was created on day four. It was created on the fourth day that this whole home of ours ever existed. And there it is, giving us light today. Have you ever heard someone say, "Don't ruin a good thing"? We really ruined a good thing. I mean, God's creation is good. And that's how we are from the very moment that we are young. We take what is good and we deviate. We pervert it. We misuse. We're destructive. And you say, "Oh, I was just on this spiritual high thinking about a sunset and sunrise, and here you go stepping on my toes." But really, though, we have to face our sin in the face every day. We live on a sin-cursed globe now because we're sinners. And the God who created the universe that we perverted and twisted for our own sinful desires came down here to live with us. And he lived and died to take our punishment so that we could find rescue in the work of Jesus. He bought our rescue with his blood and rose victorious and lives to plead our case before the Father so that the Father's wrath would be appeased and pacified. Because the Father looks at the blood of Christ as an everlasting satisfaction of the Father's just wrath against sinners. What love and care our Creator took to form this globe for our inhabiting, and what love and care Jesus had for us to offer himself up and allow us to look on him whom we have pierced and say, "I repent of my sin, I believe in Jesus, I declare him my Lord," and be accepted as a child of God through no work of our own, but solely on the merits of Christ our Creator. And so the question this morning is, do you love him? Do you tell him that you love him? And do you show him that you love him? He is the Creator, from landscapes to skyscapes, in just a few words. Let's pray.